Dive into Six Music on the BBC Sounds app and discover all our latest shows, sessions and mixes.
Six Music.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett and you're listening to a brand new series of The First Time here on BBC Six Music and BBC Sounds. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the first pivotal musical moments that made them who they are today.
Freedom in the quiet, freedom when the pain stops, freedom strikes the good, freedom likes it tough, freedom's happy enough, freedom calls you bluff. If you understand that freedom's in the quiet, freedom when the pain stops, freedom strikes the good, freedom likes it tough, freedom's happy enough, freedom calls you bluff. If you understand that it's making no sense, like I'm gonna share, see the big bad bear in the mirror. I don't feel dreaded. You think you're not care? How can I speak it any clearer? You ain't got a clue. Honey, I'm fed up. You're feeding that head with the bad blues and the divas. Now I wanna prove I'm closer to the legend. If I cheat death, oh, and I leap into the river, river. Freedom strikes the good, freedom likes it tough, freedom's happy enough, freedom calls you bluff. If you understand that freedom's in the quiet, freedom when the pain stops, freedom strikes the good, freedom likes it tough, freedom's happy enough, freedom calls you bluff. If you understand that, ooh, it's making no sense, like I'm gonna give in. Give it all till I'm dead. Now I wanna prove closer to the limit. If I ever cared, if I ever felt like living, it's got me amused. Honey, I'm fed up. Get up out of bed in a room full of demons. Cause now we got a clue closer to the legend. If we cheat death, oh, when we leap into the river, river.
Today's guest is a musician, multi-instrumentalist, singer and producer who, in a very unassuming way, has helped shape the sound of so much of the music we hear on this station. He helped bring an alternative edge to modern soul, touching on R&B, reggae and jazz. But while these sounds found their way into the mainstream, often via his collaborations with people like Lorde Carter, his deeply honest, confessional and heartfelt vocals make him stand apart, as does his total control of his brilliant vision. I'm very happy to welcome to The First Time today, Jordan Rakai. And you just heard Freedom from Jordan's most recent album, The Loop. In this interview, we cover Jordan's childhood, born in Hamilton, New Zealand, before moving to Brisbane, Australia, and then a huge leap to London, and the musical journey he took along that way, making up songs as a kid, creating beats in school, and then embarking on uploading tracks online before self-releasing his first EP, Franklin's Room, in 2013 via Bandcamp. all the time, quietly, relentlessly creating and moving forward, adopting influences and learning how to create a deeper connection with his work and his lyrics. We cover his debut album, 2016's acclaimed Cloak, and the evolution that he experienced during the follow-ups Wallflower and The Loop, the latter very much shaped by his experiences as a new parent. And we play some of the music that he loves. But I started by asking Jordan, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music as a child?
Okay, I have an early memory. Lots of my parents always hosted parties, so there's that regard of like music in the house. But I have an early memory of like going to rugby training, maybe the when I was five, and that song, "Darling, When Will You Be Mine?" Da 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 da. My mum would always like play that, and we'd always sing it in the car with my three brothers. That's one of my earliest memories. So maybe five or so.
Was music like something that was just on in the background everywhere? Was it kind of revered? Was it like, now we're putting on a record?
Or it was a mixture of both. Definitely always on. Right. Like my mum would create mixtapes and playlists. She would have, we would have like record players, but there was also lots of times my dad would come in and go like, listen to this solo and Bob Marley's Waiting in Vain. Listen to the guitar solo. It's incredible. Or listen to Pink Floyd, what they did with this Wall of Sound or something like that. But this is when I was maybe like 9 to 2, a bit older, but the early days, music was like always on, like so much, all the cooking, like in the car, anything like that, yeah, it's always on.
So there was an environment where it was like, oh, this is an interesting piece of music. This is something that you should...
Yeah, definitely. That was like more of my dad's side, because he was the, you know, he would always say to me, the pop charts, because the pop charts in my heyday would have been like early R&B pop or like Good Charlotte, and like pop punk was the time, so it's like R&B pop or like Good Charlotte. And he was like, Jordan, if you dig back, you know, when I was growing up, like Hendrix was different, or like he was talking about The Cure back in the 80s, and I'd be like, Dad, that's whack, I don't like it, whatever. But then he would like play something from that sort of always came across, like Pink Floyd, I really resonated, or some of Frank Zappa's stuff I really resonated with, because it's like weird and it's sort of like groovy. This is the Zappa era with like the jazz band like George Duke and stuff. And I remember being taken back by that. And actually the biggest change in my like awareness of how deep music could be when my dad came back from somewhere with this famous French compilation, which is like a jazz. It's called Saint-Germain Jazz Compilations, not the artist Saint-Germain. Like it's like a cafe in France that used to put together these CDs. And it would be like acid jazz, new jazz, house jazz, like that sort of 90s dance music.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of sort of my whole entry into my own taste, was that era of him showing me that.
What was the first thing that you bought, the first piece of music you bought with your own money that was like...
It was probably Stevie Wonder, Songs in the Key of Life. I mean, I always knew it, but I was like, I want to own something. And then it actually also would have been like Tupac, All Eyes on Me, which is like a single. All eyes on me.
All eyes on me. There you go, that's it.
It was very different.
Everything you need.
Yeah, but Tupac was great because he had like great musical stuff, like the chords and stuff. That's when I started getting into like the chords, which would have been my mum's influence to like disco, Motown, Stevie, Donny Hathaway, stuff like that. It was like all the chords, the harmonies, that sort of thing.
And in terms of that, the separation between hearing music and it being something that a person can do, like, because music when you're a kid is, oh, this is just this beautiful thing that makes me feel a certain way. But then you're like, well, maybe I can play something. Maybe I can create something. When did that first happen for you? Was there a moment you were like, oh, this is a chord?
Yeah, a little bit. The first song, I actually wrote a song in my grandparents' house in New Zealand, actually, with my uncle's guitar. And it was my first, I could play guitar then, but I was like, I'm going to write a song with my brother, actually, at the time. We were like, I was 10 and he was like 9. And it was about Tiger Woods and how he was the best golfer and stuff. But we were like, we came out and like presented it to the room, the uncles, and everyone was laughing. I was like, we just made that. It was sort of like a game. Like, we made this from scratch. People felt a certain way, and then it became this whole thing where me and my brothers would, like, make beats on Fruity Loops and show the adults and who had the best beat. It was, like, a sort of more gamified, but I used to love just making it for fun, just making it all the time.
Because that's still part of it, isn't it? It's there's... I guess it's the same for most creative endeavors, but there isn't anything until you make the thing. And then there is a, you know, at the end of the day or the end of that session, there is a piece of work that wasn't there before. It's magic, really.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, and you felt that early.
I felt that early. And I actually, that's one of the one things that stayed, you know, it's been 20 something years since the Tiger Woods song.
Yeah.
And I still get that. You know, I even say to my wife now, like, people wake up, there's lots of songwriters that sort of are waiting for that inspiration. They're like, oh, today's not the day, I'm just going to chill, watch a movie, whatever. But I'm of the belief where if you go into that room, for example, my studio or my garden, I'm like giving myself the opportunity to find that new thing. Like if I just do it, even if I'm feeling uninspired, I will come out of that day with something that never existed.
Yeah.
And it's really fun, like finding it, that first hour of being like, where should I take this? I think back to that teenager, because when it started getting more serious, where I'd like make beats and put them on MySpace or something like that when I was like 15, 16, I was very like proud and like always just every day, no matter what, I would always make a song. That was like my rule. And it's sort of stayed the same. I got less time now. I have a family and I'm touring or something like that. But when I have a day off, it would be making music for sure.
Yeah. We did this show, we did it with Damon Albarn and we did it in his studio. And I was talking about this, the muse. And he says, no, I have breakfast and I come to the studio and I go to work.
Yeah.
And then I finish at like 7:30, go make dinner for the family. It's like, that's inspiration doesn't happen unless you do the 9 to 5.
Totally, yeah. And even for me, we have like a hard cut where I'm like, no matter how much it's vibing right now, I have to pick up my son from nursery at 5. And there's been many, even recently, like last week, I had that. I was about to sing this chorus. I was like, oh, it's 4:50. I have to quickly voice memo this. I'm going to forget. And then anyway, I was always like, it's always been fine. I've been doing that for a few years now. And whenever I come back the next morning, it's always fine to revisit it. It's never like I've lost the magic.
Yeah.
If you just keep it, if you keep at it like Damon Albarn, if you're like consistent, you'll just get more done. That's like my belief.
Yeah. What was your first performance, your first, aside from the Tiger Woods song, which I want to hear the lyrics to, by the way?
No.
What was the first
show in high school? You have those sort of like end of year three song recitals.
All right. Yeah.
That was one of the first, like sitting in front of a room singing. I would count those, but I was very shy back then and my parents weren't allowed to hear me. So after the Tiger Woods era, it very quickly, I became like an adolescent teenager and was like very guarded. I would do like YouTube videos and no one was allowed to know, and or I would sing downstairs and no one could hear me. And then, but then they had all heard I was doing these sort of high school, you have to do it in music class, like sing two songs of your favorite songs this year, whatever. Those performances, I would consider, you know, like sort of my first ones, but my first sort of official ones would have been more like singing at my local pub, like some original stuff, some of my favorite covers of all time sort of thing. And I would do that. That was my first job, performing to like rooms of sometimes no one or like loud Aussie blokes just chatting, watching the races or something. I'm like, I'm just sitting here singing like, I don't know, Creedence Clearwater Revival or something like that. But yeah, lots of just random pub music.
That's really interesting, isn't it? You've got this thing you're saying as a teenager, like I don't want anyone to know I'm doing this. I feel really self-conscious. You can't hear it, but I'm still going to do it. I still feel compelled to do it, even though it makes me feel awkward and I don't want anyone to know I'm doing it. That's a strange...
I've never thought of that, actually, to keep doing it.
Yeah.
I used to just love making music, and we would have so many parties at our house. I would sort of sometimes find the studio or my bedroom as like this little escape, and I'd make all this music and it would just be so fun making it. But now I'm like, I want to put this on YouTube, or I want to sing a song, you know, like a Bruno Mars song back in my teenage years. And then I want to post it because I want to see what strangers sing, not my friends and family. But it was actually my brother, and I'm very thankful for him. He actually annoyingly found a YouTube video of mine and spread it around the school. And it was going off, as in like people were loving it, sharing it on their MySpace or Bebo. That's what we had back then. And that actually inspired me. Like I got over that hurdle.
Right.
And then I started, making music, posting it to MySpace, telling people at school. And then it became like people's ringtones or whatever. And there are similar tracks to like Tiger Woods, like my Xbox song. And I've got like songs about teachers and stuff like that. It was, music in my teenage years was like a game, but it was just so much fun.
Because we're going to play some music of people that mean a lot to you throughout your life during this interview. So where should we go?
Well, if we're starting in that era, I'd probably just say Stevie Wonder, My Sharia Moore. That was on all of my mum's mixtapes. She would make a new mixtape, but that song would always
on every single one.
Yeah, so that one probably be my biggest tune of my childhood.
What was your first release? What was the first thing that you officially, not just like put out for whoever to find, but like with intent, released with intent?
Yeah, so it was my first single from my first EP, Franklin's Room, which is called Selfish. And I just made this at university when you get like a studio, you get your like, again, similar like end of year assignment, make an EP sort of thing. That EP was my assignment.
All right, like 2013,
so,
right?
2013, yeah. So I made the EP and then... there's like, so I'm the music artist student, there's a music management student. They were like teaching us about EPKs and building a press kit. And anyway, they're like, you have to drop a single and then build a Facebook following and all that stuff. So I dropped a single for free on Bandcamp and SoundCloud. Yeah, it was just like a snowball effect, people talking about it. Yeah, that was the beginning for me.
How did that make you feel as someone that, like, when people start to understand what you're doing, start to come to that point, okay, this could be, I could do this. As a career, yeah. As not as a career, but like my vocation, I'm not going to potentially end up doing something that I don't love and music as a sideline. I will, yeah. I have the facilities to be able to become a musician.
Yeah.
That moment, can you remember just realizing that?
Yeah, that sort of actually came. So even before I went to university for music, I was going to go and study structural engineering or something like that. That was my goal because I was good at maths in high school. And it was actually my parents that said, just please try. You've been making music. Just try it as a course.
That's the other way around. It's supposed to be like...
classic opposite
like
story.
Get on with that engineering job and you can always have music as a hobby. They were literally the other way around. That's so sweet.
Yeah,
and then
in that university, I remember one of the lecturers coming up to me after I'd sang like a Joe Cocker cover. He was like, you have a career in this. Like, you can be a singer for a function band, wedding band. You can be an artist. You just need to learn how to start writing your own music as well. He didn't know about my Tiger Woods song or anything like that. But he said, like, you know, you can go to pubs, sing covers, but why don't you try and write some of your own music because you have a lot of potential. Because he had seen all the other students, like, we're all of, like, doing covers, you know, singing Van Morrison and like Mustang Sally, that sort of like, or what I would call like pub band music, function music. And he was just like, I see you and I want you to try and push yourself to do your own thing. So him doing that mixed with my assignment, he sort of, that gave me a realization like, oh, wow, maybe I could actually do this for my job sort of thing.
Yeah.
Because I was still, at that time, still working in like a supermarket, filling the shelves, just funding that little EP.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What were your first impressions of coming to London?
Oh, it was insane. I didn't even know where to start. Like, the cultural thing, so many, London is like five cities in one. That alone, everyone's music taste was so different. Like, growing up in Australia at that time, it wasn't pre-internet, but it was, the internet didn't have as much influence on like the local scene. Coming here, people were into like Burial and people love like Floating Points, but then they love like reggae and showing me like lots of crazy hip-hop, UK hip-hop, and then grime or anything like that. And I was just so blown away by like the eclectic sound. And also everyone was just as driven as me as like this whole, we're just going to work today. You know,
right.
London has this sort of grind. And so I was catching up with people in these early sessions being like, yeah, let's make a song, you know. And they're like, yeah, let's go. We'd make a song, have lunch, come back, work really late. But everyone just was like wanting to make music. And that's what I love doing. So I was like, I'm having fun.
And you connected with people pretty quickly, right?
Really quickly. Within like 2 weeks, I'd met actually a lot of my original little mini scene, which is like Tom Misch, who's you know, Loyal Kana. Those guys were all, they're actually younger than me, but I was 22. They were like 18, 19, going to Trinity. And we were all like making beats just for this fun thing. We actually had a night where we like did a beat battle where we had 2 minutes to make a beat each, and it was like a really fun gamified thing. And it was one of my early, I still remember that memory so much. And now they're all like off killing it, you know, Loyal's doing what he's doing, same as Tom and Alphamist and Barney, like some of my earliest friends. But having that community within like a month, I was like, yeah, I'm definitely staying here, because my original plan was to come for a few months. But yeah, straight away I just fell in love with the country.
What would be a record or an artist from that time that...
Wow, from that time, definitely James Blake. I knew a bit of James Blake in Australia, but he's weirdly, people don't really hear it because we have sort of similar voice, but his music, like a track called Digital Lion, actually is a pretty mental song. That really influenced me to like push into like a more experimental phase of music. And that affected my next album that I made called Wallflower, which is very electronic. So yeah, that would be my song.
Digital life.
going back to that first album, the statement of the first record.
Yeah.
Were you able to carry that quite lightly? Because there's always expectation, personal expectation. Oh, this is the first. These 12 tracks will be my grand statement to the world.
Yeah.
And actually what you should just do is just make it and not worry about it.
Yeah.
Which of those sides did you fall upon?
I had a little bit of that stress and pressure leading up to it. I remember I was speaking with an independent, they're called Cobalt at the time, or AWOL, where they were giving me advice on, this is going to be big for you, Jordan, like that this is a debut album, are you sure these are the tracks? This, like what you said, that big statement. And I was a bit nervous, but I had come from that, the MySpace era and SoundCloud era. I just want to release stuff all the time.
Right.
I'm going to make another album in a year's time. But I remember releasing the album and it did very well looking back. But at the time, I thought it was going to be this big explosion that everyone had talked about. You know, like a lot of bands in a similar space. Because at that time, actually, like sort of like jazz, hip-hop, soul was sort of blowing. Kendrick Lamar had just released that like jazz record, like To Pimp a Butterfly. And it was on the map of like Anderson Paak, Robert Glasper, all these like big names, even Thundercat actually. And I was like, this is another good record in that mix. And then it just did pretty well. You know, I sold all my tickets out to all my shows. It streamed really well. It still streams really well. But I thought it was going to being young, not dropping an album, I thought it was going to like explode me like Sam Smith or something, like a massive worldwide explosion. But I realized the music was quite niche. But I went straight into making another album 2 months after I dropped it. And then a year later, I dropped another album. So, and it's basically been the same ever since. I've just been, as soon as I finish one, I make another one. Well, I just love making music, so that's my vibe.
Let's talk about another artist. In fact, we have to talk about Radiohead, because I think the last time I spoke to you was at the Six Music Festival and you were supporting Smile. And we had a long chat about how mind-blowing that was just as an experience. But like, when did you first really kind of fall in love with Radiohead and kind of how... I mean, they've impacted on everybody.
Yeah, they have. You know. And that's what I've been learning. The more I get older and meet other musicians, it's just like, it's like a rite of passage. At some stage, you're going to discover Radiohead and they're going to have an impact on you, whether you go back. But I remember actually still being in my pop R&B phase as a teenager, and this guy who had really interesting taste from his older brother, he was my age, he was 16, but he showed me, it's pretty classic, but he showed me Weird Fishes, which is, for someone that loves pop R&B soul disco stuff, is actually quite a good gateway into Radiohead, because it's groovy, it's nice chords, and it's like beautiful melody and stuff. And it really floored me. I literally remember exactly where I was. I was at rowing camp and we were like in the bunks playing music while we were like playing board games. And he put it on. I was like, bro, what is it? I sort of like just stopped. It's like so ethereal, ambient. It had reminded me of like my earlier Pink Floyd stuff my dad showed me. That day, I went back from rowing camp and like did a deep dive into Radiohead. And I was like, I don't get it. Some of it's a bit different from that song. And he's like, man, everything is different. Like, it's so progressive. And then I grew to, easily my favorite band since that moment. That was 2007 when In Rainbows came out. And even going back, like some of their older records I really love, which is what, like you meet a Radiohead fan, they're very like, they like a certain era, but I just love all of their music. It's so genius. Yeah. My favorite song from Radiohead though, from that album, would probably be Nude actually. How like the extreme discrepancy of like really ambient strings and then this really small, minimal moment with just bass and drums. It's just so beautiful.
Yeah. Flower, that was the first album on Ninja Tune, right?
Yeah.
Like, tell me a bit about that progression for that record.
Yeah, so I signed actually to Ninja Tune because I started getting into the electronic space. I feel like I needed to position myself because when I had self-released my album before, Into the Abyss, like I was trying to be this sort of soul guy, and but I wasn't positioned next to anyone, so I felt like a bit alone trying to tell that story. And when you drop something on Ninja, people already subconsciously expect, is this going to sound like, at the time, like Floating Points, Bonobo. And there's actually quite a couple of those influences. You know, it's still my sound, but it's instead of a piano, it's a synth or something like that. Or instead of drums, it might be programmed.
Yeah.
And they were a great like partner in that first record of like also saying, have you checked this out? You know, Young Fathers at the time were dropping one of their earlier records, and they were just a great person to lean on in terms of like influences and production techniques or anything like that. Because I produce everything myself. So
yeah.
I'm like almost acoustic guy, like any advice and what to, they're like, check out this record, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, that's amazing. Yeah. And it inspired me. So there's a lot of like, that was my second year in London and lots of learning in that early relationship with Ninja of their back catalog inspirations and electronic music.
Yeah. Because there was a quote from you and you said, I'm just a producer that sang. So I had to become a front man, which I thought was sounds quite simple, but there's a lot of weight to that comment, I think.
No, I even struggle with this to this day. I'm a studio person at heart because of my bedroom back as a teenager. Mm. I love getting into a room, creating, writing the song, building the little world around it. And this is extremely first world problem, but it's sort of annoying that I sing on it as well because like I would love to just make music every day if I could. But when you sing and also when you sing on your own music, you are then the front of the product, what I would say, and you have to go and play shows and you have to also like do everything that a product does. But if I was to produce, let's say I produce for like Adele or something, it'd be such a high scale product, but I could just be in the background going to the supermarket or whatever. No one would know who you are. And it's sort of, it goes back to no one knowing about the YouTube thing.
It's just like, what I was about to say. Yeah, it's a similar kind of thing.
It's like, I love doing it, but maybe because even I had that weird dynamic and complex in my mind where early in my career I was this frontman singer, but I'm very shy on stage and I don't have that charisma that a usual front person has where they're like going around asking for crowd interaction. And I realized like when I saw James Blake live, he's very in his space, doesn't do much dancing around. In fact, he just sits down.
Yeah.
And that was so inspirational. Like, yeah, I can just sit there and sing. You know, that's what I'm doing anyway. That's my world. And that's what I can like offer. And then, yeah, since that's been a big like weight off my shoulders. But I love being an artist because I love being able to tell my own story with like my own lyrics. And as I've grown, I've got more to talk about because I've got like more important things like children or like love or anything like that. But at that phase, I found much more joy in just creating and making music and then just singing on top, because I was like, well, this needs some vocals, and that's what happened. Yeah.
Guess what I've got to do.
Yeah.
What artist should we go for next?
Well, it's another older artist, but I loved him growing up, but I had a second wind with Jeff Buckley when I moved to London because of the melancholy Radiohead era, I would say. I read an interview, actually, Tom York was saying he was inspired by Jeff Buckley when they wrote their first album. I was like, I can hear it now. It's funny, you can sort of... This is no shade on Tom York, because he's one of my favorite ever artists, but I'm more of a singer-singer than Tom York, but I sing his melodies sometimes. And so I would be doing... And I realized I'm actually sometimes singing more Jeff Buckley's melodies, who's more of a singer-singer. Like,
yeah.
He's regarded as one of the great singers of the 90s. So I realized, like, I was, like, indirectly being influenced by Jeff through their choices.
Yeah.
Like, the droning stuff and, like, the slides and stuff like that. Yeah, Jeff Buckley, for example, a song called Grace. Again, Jeff Buckley's one of those artists that everyone loves. Well, when they just really, truly discover it. But, again, growing up in soul, hip-hop, and, like, jazz, disco music, Jeff Buckley was, like, this gateway out of that into this, like, alternative rock space. But he still sings, I think, very soulfully. So. Yeah. That would be easily, like, yeah, one of my biggest influences.
Who were your first production heroes? Who were the first people that you like, not just necessarily artists, but people that go, oh, you've made that sound.
Mm.
How did you make that sound? Who are the people?
Yeah, my first production heroes would probably be, again, I'm thinking back to my teenage years, like the Neptunes, they were on everyone's music back then.
Yeah.
And I obviously discovered them through like Justin Timberlake and like Usher as well. Timbaland. So there's a lot of like the hip hop producers, like the in the box beat maker crew. But then with Radiohead, obviously, is Nigel Godrich. He's now probably still my favorite producer. When no matter what record he's produced, I always will check, even if it's a completely different genre. But yeah, he was, when I was about, I don't know, 15, I discovered him and then dive into all the back catalogue of what he had done. But it'd be weirdly like the hip-hop guys and then Nigel Godrich. that's about it. And even still to this day, I check, you know, if the Neptunes make some music or Pharrell, I would still check it, or Timbaland, even just check the beat. And yeah, it's still something I'm like touching base with.
What's a track, maybe what's a hip-hop track that you think like, that's if I could have made something?
Oh, I mean, one of my favorite ever hip-hop tunes from that era was Missy Elliott, Pass That Dutch. Just the beat and her whole charisma, like her whole charisma of that era was just incredible. I remember me and my brothers like trying to like rap like her, and I was like, oh God, it's cringy now thinking about it. But that's why I got into the beat side, because I couldn't rap. So I was like, I just want to make the beats for these rappers. And so that would be one of my favorites from that era.
Boy, here I come, pumps in the bump, make you wanna hurt something. I can take your man, I don't have to sex some. Hang him out the window, call me Michael Jackson. I'm a pain in your rectum. I am that bitch y'all slept on. Heavy hit around, spit up, call me rerun. Hey, 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 I'm what's happening. Hypnotic in my drink, that's right. Shake till it stink, that's right. Mr. Moe's on the beat, that's right. Put it down for the street, that's right. Pass the Dutch, baby. Shake, shake, shake your stuff for me. Jiggle that fat, don't stop, get it till your clothes get wet. Number one, drums go bump, bump, bump. This beat here will make your home bump jump. If you's a fat one, put your clothes back on before you start putting potholes in my lawn. Oh my gosh, oh my gosh, I'm under attack like my name was Saddam. I am the bomb from New York to Milan, and now I can write a song sicker than Jeffrey Dawn. Couldn't touch my car alarm, breaking my car, you will hear Viper arm. I've been a superstar since Daddy King was raw. I'm live on stage, come on and give me some applause. Thank you. Oh, thank you. You all are so wonderful. Come on, pass the Dutch, baby. Shake, shake, shake your stuff for this. Pop that, jiggle that fat. Don't stop, get it till your clothes get wet. Listen up. You have 5 seconds to catch your breath. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. That make that money, just keep it going like the Energizer Bunny. Shift that, shake that, move it all around. Spank that, yank that Dutch back now. Freak him, freak her, whatever your choice. Didn't come to judge, I came to get your moist. Scream, my voice is lost. Can I get a ride on a white horse? Come on, pass the Dutch, baby. Shake, shake, shake your stuff for this. Jiggle that fat, don't stop, get it till your clothes get wet. Pop that. That's a Dutch, baby. Jiggle that fat.
We talked a lot about the loop, and we talked about how becoming a dad, not just emotionally changed you as a creator, but also kind of like physically the way you made music.
Yeah.
To the point of like, well, I'll just have to play this song really quietly because I'm going to wake up. I'm going to wake up the little one. Tell me about that. How do you now you've had a bit of distance on that, looking back at that evolution, that change, how do you feel about not the new you, but like the you that you became around that record? Because it also kind of sailed quite close to like a broader audience as well, that album kind of reached out further, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. And it was amazing. Like a lot of people connected with it and I felt like my most vulnerable lyrical stuff. And it was like, it gave me confidence to go deeper onto the vulnerable side for my own songwriting. And also making that record, I had a lot of balance when I was writing it, with balancing family time, like childcare, literally not being out of work, and also being very like focused about, you know, Monday I have to be able to work because on Tuesday I'm going to be off with my son. And I've actually kept that going because I've had another child actually who's 9 months now, and my oldest is now 3.5. And I find the balance really amazing for me. Like last year was easily my favorite year of probably my life. Obviously, I've got kids, so it should be. But yeah, like I had amazing balance of time off, like parental duties. And then when I was working, I was really working and really focused. And actually having that clarity means like work, you can be super present. And then with the personal aspect, you can be super present as well. You're not living in this, you know, I'm not living on my phone trying to check emails at the same time as being at the soft player sort of thing. So having that now, like I'm writing another record, it's just like I feel so clear mentally. I'm lyrically talking about vulnerable stuff. I'm super able to be super present in my children's lives. And I'm able to like cope, like I'm being productive. The children haven't held my productivity back, if you know what I mean, which is like a common myth. You get no time as a parent, but you do if, I feel like you do if it's like clear what the boundaries are, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I'm also lucky because I'm self-employed in that regard. Like I can understand if you have to work Monday to Friday, it's harder to like put that time in. But for me, it really works.
Yeah. Mm. And how's your methodology changed now? Because you seem to be, from what you seem to be like, of all the things, the evolutions, you seem to be in the best possible place right now.
Yeah.
And though creatively, that friction and feeling uncomfortable or coming into a new scene, all these things can be kind of useful grit for work. And if you're in a really happy place.
Yeah.
Is that, how has it changed your creativity, do you think?
Yeah. So it's made me, on one side, for example, when I'm writing a lyric, I'm very quickly able to say to myself, does this just make me feel something? Mm. Rather than, is it just a filler like the old producer that sang sort of era? I want to be saying something that I actually mean, otherwise I'm just going to get rid of it. So it moves that part of the songwriting much faster because I'm able to make that decision a lot faster. And then when I'm producing, because I've got a studio at home since I moved out of London, like I'm writing and building this whole world. And then now I know, because I'm really busy with childcare, in 6 months' time, I'm just going to book 2 weeks in the studio. I've already pre-messaged the nursery to make sure we can have those extra days.
Yeah.
And then that studio time is very focused.
Right.
And then I'm just building on what I'd done in my studio at home. And then I come home and do post-production and tidy it all up and then finish my record just in my house at the same time as, you know, for example, like tomorrow I have a day off because Wednesdays is my day off. It's like a non-negotiable. And it's funny, I could have a really busy day on Tuesday. No matter how much I need to get done, it has to wait till Thursday. But having that, knowing that now, it just means I work harder on Tuesday and Thursday because I'm missing that day.
Yeah.
But it works. Yeah, it really just makes it so much easier.
Knowing, yeah. It's interesting what you say there about, like, it's really got to make you feel something.
Yeah.
Like, if I'm going to put my time into it now, it really has to be.
Yeah.
It has to be good.
Yeah, there's an amazing Nick Cave book. He wrote it, and it's about songwriting and how he approaches it. And he just says, if you feel uncomfortable about a lyric, it's the right choice. And I've ever since I read that about 3 years ago, it's just been at the forefront of my mind this whole time. Is that lyric, like, if I'm talking about something, you know, deep with my mother or something, I'm like, I should be saying that as strong as possible rather than just like a surface level, you know, I miss you sort of thing. It should be like, why? Or how can I say that where it really makes me feel uncomfortable that maybe, I don't know. I'm trying to think like that.
Yeah.
Like, how do I feel uncomfortable or positive? It's not always bad. It can be positive as well. But if you're like, no, I do love my child, so I'm just literally going to say that. Like, that's what I feel.
And what's happening now musically? Tell me about what's been going on.
So I've been spending the last 18 months at Abbey Road as an artist in residence, which is amazing. I've been collaborating yeah, with just heaps of people just coming through.
Wow.
It's amazing having that like venue and studio is like a negotiation thing. Like, do you want to come and work with me at Abbey Road? People are like, of course, I'll
yes,
come.
Yes, we do.
Yeah.
That would be nice.
They just want to come for the studio. So I had been there since last year and I've been working on heaps and heaps of like collaborations, which is something I never usually do because when I make albums, I always feel like I want to be the one telling my whole story. So I'm quite selfish in the regard of like collabs on my own music. But I write a lot for other people before Abbey Road. But now like I'm working a lot with artists, just like having fun with it. Similar to those teenage days of like, let's get in the studio. We have a great studio and there's all this gear and we can just make whatever we want. No pressure. And it's been really fun. Like, going into these days with the, like we talked about before, no idea to suddenly, and I've got a song, for example, I released a song last year with Jalen and Gonda. We're sort of like, I would say aligned influence wise. He's got more of like an older school taste. But we got together, it just clicked because he's open-minded as well. And we were just writing for fun. And then suddenly the track's out. It's like, it's really happy, not happy-go-lucky. That's the wrong word. It's a really just like, carefree creative experience, and we just want to get it out for the fun of it, not overthinking the whole the stress of the campaign world. You know what I mean? When you make an album, it's very like, what's the visual, what's, you know, what's the singles, that sort of thing. It's just a really fun like collaborative experience.
And the final question, what should we end the show on?
So one of my favorite new artists is an artist from America called Madison Cunningham. Like, she comes from an Americana background, but she's got a lot of, like, what I would say, musical theory assets in her brain. So she's very, like, polyrhythmic stuff. There's a lot of jazz harmony. She's just an incredible, incredible songwriter. And she just released an album last year called Ace. And it's one of my favorite albums of the year. So, yeah, and my favorite track from her at the moment on her new album is called My Full Name. And it's just, yeah, it's such an eclectic mix of influences.
Have you got that desire to kind of, you say, like, having done all this collaborative stuff recently, is there that hit list of like, I want to work with her, I want to work with him? Is that something that
it's so funny, actually. People that I really, really, really love, like, she's one of those one every 5 year new discoveries to me. I actually sometimes don't want to because I'm intimidated to work with someone that I really love. Not on the whole thing of meeting your heroes, more just like, I don't know what I would bring to someone like that. I even had a thing I said to my label recently where I was like, I would love for Nigel Godrich to produce a song for me, but then I was nervous thinking, I don't know like if I got anything good enough for him to produce. It's sort of like a confidence thing. Yeah, so even like Timbaland, Pharrell, anyone like that, I would be really nervous going into a room with. But not to say the people I've collaborated aren't like that, but it's a different thing when it's like your top five people currently. Yeah, I would feel very nervous. But I would love to work with her one day when I get some confidence.
It's been good to speak to you. Thank you.
You too.
So
thanks for having me.
Thank you.
I love it when you say my full name and the way you always speak your mind. But he doesn't really know you. I've been spinning out on too many big words you could do without, and everything we dare not say out loud are written on our faces. There's a water size of Berlin coming from this vessel that we're in, running from my eyes to your chin. Love's a kind of sorrow worth saving when a part of me went missing. A case was never written in these verses. to every living thing that isn't you. And as I say it now, I know it's true. You know very well I can wait around, but since it's getting too late to change it now, might as well.
That was Madison Cunningham with My Full Name, the final choice of my guest on the first time, Jordan Rakai. And what a beautiful way to end this show, and indeed this series. Thank you to all my guests, all of whom you can hear on BBC Sound. So there's Peaches, Hannah Peel and Emma Jean Thackeray's first time. And of course, you can dig into the archive and hear previous first time shows with people like Elton John, Florence Welsh and Chris Cornell. There'll be more first times coming up later in the year. Until next time, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.